This podcast is proud to be part of the TalkSport Fan Network. TalkSport. Powered by fans.
And there it is. That's as good as it gets on this stage. Nissan Townstar EV strikes again. It's an unstoppable van. Unstoppable!
Look, just fantastic. You can actually see the ProPilot technology in action. Effortless parallel parking.
It moves with all the confidence that comes with a 5-year warranty.
And with a bench full of all-star van experts, there's real strength in depth here.
That's all-star quality.
Search Nissan Townstar EV and visit your local all-star van centre to see for yourself.
Terms and conditions apply. 5 years or 100,000 miles, whichever comes first.
ProPilot is an advanced driver assist technology. Driver's responsibility to stay alert, drive safely, and control vehicle at all times.
The TalkSport Fan Network is proudly supported by McDelivery, bringing you the food you love. McDelivery brings a top-tier lineup of food right to your door. No matter the result, you'll always be winning with McDelivery. So, the only thing left to say is, you win? Order now on the McDonald's app, and you can also get rewards points delivered too, so that ordering today means some tasty rewards for tomorrow. Only via app at participating restaurants. 18 plus, rewards registration required. Points only on menu items. Delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com. Welcome back. This is the Chelsea Fancast. I, of course, am Stamford Chidge. And in the blue corner, I have wearing his purple Superman t-shirt, Mr. Jonathan Kidd.
Up, up, up and away.
Indeed, indeed. And in the other blue corner, an absolute wonderful, wonderful gentleman, Mr. Mark Meehan.
Good evening, everybody.
There you go. I genuinely mean this. A lot of people... are showing a lot of love for the 50 years of Chelsea that we've been doing. I know we enjoy it, which is really what it's all about, and that's why we do it. But in a perverse sort of way, Mark, I've been looking forward to doing this season, largely because I was getting a bit older. I was kind of 13, 14. So whilst I wasn't going to Stamford Bridge, that was a bit of an alien concept to me at the time. This is the season I remember watching on the big match, perhaps more than any other, and this was borne out by the amount of matches I managed to see this afternoon when I was preparing for this. But in a sense, I said all change, but in a way there wasn't any. But the thing that kind of struck me about this was the number of new recruits that seemed to find their way into the team this season, such as Gary Chivers and Mick Fillery signed professional forms. Johnny B gets a few games. Mickey Nutton, John Sitton end up playing at the end of the season. David Stride, I think, makes a great impact. But lo and behold, we make our first signing for 4 years, I think, when we get Duncan McKenzie from Everton for £165,000 in early September. Now, I wasn't really around and going much at all. I wasn't going at all in those days. So this would have kind of passed me by. I mean, I knew Duncan McKenzie from his time at Leeds more than anything. But... going into this season, Mark, I know it was a bit disappointing last season, but going into this season, were you excited? What were your hopes and expectations? And did you feel quite happy that Duncan McKenzie had arrived?
Excited, yes. I'm an optimist by nature, so despite what happened the previous season, we still managed to stay in the first division. So looking forward to the next one. And the other thing that's really sort of was exciting for me, I had my first ever season ticket at Chelsea. So I got a £25 or Terrace season ticket that season for the first time. So I'd already committed before the ball had even been kicked. I was going to every game that season. So really looking forward to it. High hopes for the season. Disappointment. We talked about him in the last few weeks. We'd lost Jock Finiston. Ken Shelletto decided to sell him to Sheffield United.
Why? Why did they do that?
Terrible, terrible decision. And Jock never wanted to leave Chelsea, but clearly... he had a choice of going to two clubs. One was Luton Town and one was Sheffield United. So he went north to Sheffield. But we actually did bring in a player before Duncan McKenzie came in. We bought a new goalkeeper. we brought in Bob Iles during the summer.
From Weymouth.
And he makes his debut during the course of the season. And he plays, which we will talk about, that infamous Bolton game. Yeah. That was his home debut. But in terms of Duncan McKenzie...
He had a good haircut, didn't he, Iles, I remember?
Yeah. Really excited when Duncan McKenzie joined us.
Me too.
A really talented player. And in that short period of time he was with us, I think he only played 15 games. I think how I best describe Duncan, right player for Chelsea, wrong time. Just came at the wrong time. He was doing flicks and tricks. And I think when you're talking the other week about Ruud Gullit, I'm not saying that Duncan McKenzie's on the same level as Ruud Gullit, but there are times when he was doing things where he was on a different wavelength to some of his teammates. He was
a mercurial player, wasn't he, Duncan McKenzie?
He was a maverick. He was short-lived. Also, you wouldn't want him being a babysitter either, because when he was here, he was best friends with Kenny Swain. So one night, Kenny Swain and his wife Lillian went out, and Duncan offered to babysit for them. And Duncan's idea of babysitting was, I think it must have been around November time, was let off a load of fireworks in Kenny Swain's flat. So the kids loved it, but I don't think Kenny Swain was best pleased with his teammates sort of setting fireworks off in his flat. The other thing about Duncan, I know we were watching the games. The other thing I found on YouTube, and from people remember the 1970s, will remember Superstars.
Yes.
So Duncan appeared that season in Superstars, and he was really unfortunate. I watched it over the weekend. He's really unfortunate. He appeared in the same episode, and older people remember this, Brian Jacks.
Yes. So judo bloke.
The gym test. And Duncan goes first, and they do the dips. You know, older people remember what the dips were. And Duncan does 17 dips in 1 minute. And then the next person that follows him was Brian Jacks, and he does 64 dips. and over the course of that episode, Duncan finishes sort of second from bottom, which is probably a foretaste of what his football season was going to be like the remaining part of the season.
I think in honour of that, Mark, we have to do a rendition of the superb Superstars theme music. Jonathan, remember it?
Was it a bit like...
Why that never got translated to a Cheris chant, I'll never know.
Didn't McKenzie wasn't he able to vault over a mini from a standing start?
Yes, that's probably why he got on Superstars.
Yeah,
but it's true, isn't it, Mark? I mean, he could leap over a mini.
He never did it at Chelsea, but he did it at Leeds United, and he also could throw a golf ball from one end of the pitch to the other. But I think it was. It was at a testimonial game at Leeds when he jumped over me. Like, I've got Duncan's book, so I was reading it, and it's on the... If I had the camera up, you could see it. There's a big photo of him on the back page of his book jumping over the mini. But he was a talent. It was short-lived. He never actually scored a goal at Stamford Bridge in a league game, although he did score for us in a... I think it was Charlie Cook's testimonial. So all the goals he got were away from home.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he actually scored on his debut away to Coventry City.
Yeah, well,
he played for Forest, didn't he, before that? He played for Forest, because I remember seeing him playing against Fulham. He went Fulham at Forest, and he was absolutely excellent. And that consequently, I was so excited with the prospect of him coming, because I thought, well, all right, Finiston's gone. Finiston going was... what was going on in the boardroom? What was going on? How did that work? One despairs. I remember this emotion I'm feeling now was exactly what I felt then. I just constantly going, oh, why have they done this? And but by McKenzie, I went, okay, I get it if you bought a player like that. But as you say, a completely surrounded by journeymen in comparison. A real, real talent, McKenzie. And wasn't given a chance to show how brilliant he could be.
Well, but sorry, go on, mate.
No, I'm going to say.
Well, but before we get into how the season pans out, because a lot of games was to look over tonight. and all sorts of other stuff. I mean, it might have been a really pants season, but there's so much to talk about. The first of which isn't even in the official, obviously the official games that we played, but in September, on the 26th of September 1978, Chelsea played the New York Cosmos with a certain Johan Cruyff amongst them ranked. Now, I have to nail my colours to the mast here, but Johan Cruyff was one of the fundamental reasons why I love football. Watching him play in the 74 World Cup as a kind of an eight-year-old, I just fell in love with this guy and football and thought, my God, you know, one of my favourite players of all time. And, of course, the New York Cosmos were huge. I mean, that's like the height of the National Soccer League then, or, you know, North American Soccer League, as we should call it. And they come over to Chelsea. Now, I'm pretty sure you were there, JK, weren't you?
I was.
And I think Mark was probably there, weren't you, Mark?
I was indeed, along with 39,659 people. But again, as we've said before in the fan cast, there was a lot more than 39,000 people
well,
there that night.
A bit like the Moscow Dynamo game, kind of. So, Jonathan, tell me about this game. Because, I mean, there is footage of it, by the way, because I think Wilkins scored for us, didn't he? Tell me about that game. You know, what was it about? Why were we playing the New York Cosmos in September, in the season, effectively?
I think you'll have to ask Mark.
Okay. Well, I'll tell you what. I'll talk to Mark, and then we'll get your reflections of it. Yeah. Would that be more sensible? Okay.
The Cosmos Chiefs were doing a European tour.
Yeah. Right.
There was, I think, half a dozen games on that tour, and we were the only side they played in the UK. They played Bayern Munich, they played Stuttgart, they played AC Milan, they played Atletico Madrid, and they played Freiburger, which sounds like a beer in Germany. So there were the five games, and they decided to come to Stamford Bridge. And clearly, because they had, you know, not just Cruyff, they had in that side, they had Carlos Alberto was playing for them, they had Franz Beckenbauer, they had Giorgio, yeah, Italian people.
Cinaglia.
And obviously, for Watford fans who might be listening, they had Terry Garber in the side. And I think on the night, Dennis Stewart was up front for them. Dennis Stewart.
That's right.
But it really caught the imagination that, you know, people just went there just to see Cruyff. And if you remember your big match, the following season, or the same season, the opening intro of the big match, during the game, Cruyff does his Cruyff turn, and he sort of does that whole turn and beats Ray Lewington. And they show that in the big match, I think, for at least a season afterwards.
Yeah, I mean, it's bizarre how that came about. Why on earth were they playing Chelsea, Mark, without disparaging us too much?
No, I don't know why they actually chose us, but I said it, they were on tour, and whether or not we had some kind of connections with, you know, the American Soccer League back then, but...
I thought that was Mears just being clever. That's what I heard.
Good marketing.
Yeah. I thought that Mears was just on the case in this instance, despite being so dreadful in so many other areas.
What do you remember about the match, JK?
Nothing.
Nothing? Seriously?
Seriously, nothing.
That's really sad, because that's huge.
I told you this is my mind. This is what my brain... If Mark says something, I'll go, oh, yeah, of course that happened.
Well, I mean, the thing is, I mean, if you think... You know. Think about the context of this, because I know it's really odd, but Johan Cruyff... pretty much single-handedly dragged Holland to the World Cup final in 1974, where they should have beaten West Germany. He should have gone to the 78 World Cup, and this is going to feature in this episode, I think. We just had this amazing World Cup in Argentina in 78. He should have gone to that. Holland gets to the final again, loses to Argentina, as we know. But he didn't go because there were death threats against him, so he refused to go. So he's kind of, you know, it's not like he's kind of 3 or 4 years retired from decent football and just gone over to America to earn a decent crust. He's still a very, very, very good footballer. And he's playing at Stamford Bridge. I mean, you know, it's huge.
I've been watching Beckenbauer, actually, I have to tell you.
Was he playing as well?
Yeah.
Fuck. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. De Kaiser,
indeed. But he was very imperious. And also I was fascinated by the whole process of a sweeper, because he was the original sweeper. And I just liked the fact that he just tidied everything up all the time, because he was still playing in that role, because it was a role that wasn't played very often in English football.
No. Were there rumours that Chelsea were going to sign Cruyff, Mark, at that time?
Yeah, there were rumours, and that would have been an incredible signing. And on two occasions, shortly after that game, but then a couple of years later, I think when Jeff Hurst was manager, there was rumours again that we were looking to actually buy him. And I think in the end, I think he joined Levante in Spanish football, if I remember right. And I think as part of his deal with Levante, he got half the gate money of every game. So that clearly was probably the deal he put on Brian Mears, and Brian Mears probably said, no way, Jose. Yeah.
Did he not go back to Feyenoord at the end of his career and do great things with them as well, I seem to remember?
I think he may have been at Feyenoord. He certainly did play for Feyenoord at one point in his career, definitely.
Yeah. Indeed. All right, let's get into the meat and potatoes. We open the season at home to Everton, and we lose 1-0. I think the first thing that strikes me when I watch this back today was not just that we were rather poor. It's the amount of players that had perms and tashes, JK.
Well, Bob Latchford, he had his hair permed specially for the start.
He did. Didn't he? Motti actually gave that a mention, didn't he?
Everton were really good.
They weren't bad, were they?
Everton had a really good team. There were some absolutely great, some really excellent players. They had Thomas, who played for Queen's Park Rangers, who I thought was terrific. He'd been playing for England. They had Latchford. They had they bought this bloke, Mickey Walsh, from Blackpool, who had made a very good impression.
Lost to Tooth.
Andy King, who was, he had a perm as well, didn't he, old Walsh? Andy King, even I think Kenny Swain had a perm.
Kenny Swain did.
Yeah.
Gary Stanley.
Yeah, yeah.
Ian Britton. Clive Walker, what was left of his hair was permed.
I had one as well.
You did not. You so did not.
I did.
Jesus wet me. Do you know what? I was saying to Mark earlier, even in the weird kind of backwater boondocks of the middle of Hampshire where I grew up, we were getting into things like the Ruts and the Specials and bands like that, although that's more 79. So we all became rude boys overnight. I had a little red Harrington, you know. So we weren't into perms and tashes, mate. But then we were a bit younger. We couldn't have grown a tash then. Yeah. Too young.
I grew a tash at when I was in the National Youth Theatre. I grew a tash for a part.
And you had a perm.
It took me an eternity. No, not then. The perm was subsequent. I then subsequently had the perm.
There you go.
But that was with those rather large shirts that you had at the time as well, with the bits sticking out, you know.
Oh my God. And kickers. I bet you had kickers as well, didn't you? Red kickers.
How did you know?
Because I remember my fashion from those days.
Now that I won't have anything red in the house, but then I don't know.
Nor will I.
What matter with me? I don't know what I was sort of less. I think it's because United weren't the force that they then became. It was more Liverpool at the time, but even they weren't. I'm trying to think who were the best sides. But anyway, the Everton were a terrific side. And what I was terribly aware of in that very first game of the season is, even though it was only 1-0, was how completely outclassed we were. Because they just,
could have been more than one.
Oh, should have been. They just took us to the cleaners. And I'm they were very impressive. Who else did they have? Andy
Pedgick.
Pedgick, who played for Stoke. Terrific buzzy player. It just made us, you thought, I remember going and thinking, well, once again, as Mark's the same, we were saying we're optimistic. You know, you think, yeah, they're going to do, let's see what happens. He'll be much better than last season. And you think, it's men against boys here.
Well, what were your hopes, Jonathan, for the season? I mean, I know you're always optimistic.
Well, you're always optimistic. You can't help it. You just think that somehow something might come together. They might discover something. But they just looked outclassed, and it looked a division above for me from the very first game. You just thought.
So were your hopes dented massively after losing?
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. What about you, Mark? I mean, I presume you were there.
I was indeed. I remember a beautiful sunny day, over 30,000. And I think we only really began to play in about the last 20 minutes. And I think Ian Britton came on his sub about 20 minutes ago, and that's what gave us a bit of a lift. It wasn't a great start, but we'd lost, I think, the previous season to Everton 1-0 at the Bridge as well, 77-82. It didn't dent my enthusiasm before, after. I think it was after the Everton game. I then went and bought my train ticket and match ticket for Wolves on the forthcoming Tuesday evening. And we won up at Wolves. So, yeah, we may have lost at home, but I'd have probably taken sort of like a win from the first couple of games, maybe, and a draw. And we end up with a win and a draw from our first three games because we beat Wolves with a Tommy Langley goal. And then we drew at Tottenham the following Saturday.
But a couple of Swain goals. Kenny Swain, to me, was possibly the best player of that season. And then and they flog him.
Well, we'll get to the flogging later. But you're right. Two cracking goals.
A really class act, Kenny Swain.
But this was really important, you know, not least because it was, you know, probably the best run we had all season. Actually, no, we managed to win two games in a row towards the end of it or the middle of it. But as Mark will, I know, is gagging to tell us, Tottenham had just come up from the second division because they'd been relegated. So this was supposed to be, I mean, we have this habit of ruining their parties and pissing on their parade. But the other thing, you know, I mentioned the 78 World Cup. They had the much vaunted Ozzie Ardiles and Ricardo Villa playing for them. And I remember this at the time vividly. I mean, it was all Argentina crazy, wasn't it, Mark? And they had those two playing for them.
They did. They bought them sort of pre-season. They made their debut away at Nottingham Forest, and I think they played Aston Villa during the week. So this was their Saturday home debut because there was a bigger crowd than it was a London derby. And I was at White Hart Lane, and that repeat of the 78 World Cup, all the ticker tape as they came out onto the pitch, it was a replica of Argentina in the World Cup. They start well, Tottenham, and they take the lead. But each time, you know, when they take the lead, within a minute, Kenny Swain has equalised. And I think on the day, we were unlucky not to win the game. You know, it wasn't just about Ardiles. You know, in the press beforehand, it was Wilkins versus Hoddle. And I thought Wilkins had a fine game that day as well. And that probably, other than those two games, that's probably when we peaked that season. But a really tremendous point at White Hart Lane. And the other thing about that game, it was our first game back against Tottenham since they relegated us in 2005. So there was a bit of a, not surprising, a bit of a grudge attached to it. And it was the first time I'd ever been to White Hart Lane, the Chelsea-Tottenham game. So first time I'd ever been to Seven Sisters Station. And that long walk, experiencing that for the first time before and after the game, you know, quite intimidating.
Like Beirut, mate.
It was like Beirut.
I thought that they were great for the game, Ardiles and Villa. And that strange thing of that they insisted on calling him Villa. They kept calling him.
Ricky Villa.
Rather than Villa, which of course was his name. But they were terrific. Ardiles is a terrific player. They're both terrific players. And I thought it enhanced the division, actually, as a consequence, having them play.
It was real. I mean, you know, as I said, I wasn't on the football radar half as much as you two at the time. But it did. It was resounding throughout the league. I mean, it was you know, huge news. The other thing that caught my eye watching this today was, the Umbro kits, first of all, always my favourite Chelsea kit, that dark blue with the Umbro markings down the side. But, of course, this was Chelsea were playing in what I like to call our Brazil kit, you know, the yellow shirt. I mean, actually, it's more like bloody Norwich. Mark, why on earth didn't the people at the club, you know, bearing in mind they could, you know, the whole South American thing coming over, why didn't they play with the kind of the light blue shorts and flashings like Brazil did? I mean, at least we could have pretended that we were watching Brazil.
Brazil playing Argentina. Oh, I think that's very picky, Chidge. I just love that kit.
I love that kit. Don't get me wrong, man. I love it.
An absolute genius. And while we're doing the show tonight, simultaneously, if people on Twitter, Kenny Rice is doing his best ever away kit, his World Cup of away kits. And I cannot believe, because I voted for the yellow away kit.
I did too.
It got knocked out in the early rounds.
No. Jeez. That's criminal.
And I don't, you know, I rarely buy. It's been years since I bought a shirt. But, you know, I've had that shirt, and that's one of my prized Chelsea possessions. You know, I've got that yellow and green shirt, and I've got it signed by all the players from that era. I've got it done while I was doing the Eddie Mack book. As I did with each player, I got each of them assigned that shirt till I ended up with the whole team. So that's got pride of place at home, that shirt. And also, if you've seen the photo of Kenny Swain, there's a great photo. I think Hugh Hastings might have taken it with his arm aloft as he scores at White Hart Lane. And I've got that picture framed with Kenny signed. Yeah, that was a
excellent,
brilliant day at White Hart Lane. We should have won the game.
And that was kind of pretty much the high point of the season. So we can all go home now. No, we can't really. Don't worry. Don't let the truth get in the way of a good story, Mark. we then lose at home 3-0 to Leeds, which must have been terrible. We lose away to Coventry. I mean, this is basically the start of this awful, awful run that we go on. Just to kind of ruin it for everybody, basically, we don't win a match from having beaten Wolves or drawing against Spurs on the 26th of August. We then lose 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 matches and draw one before we play Bolton on the 14th. But before that, the arguably the worst one is the Chelsea versus City match, Mark, where we got dubbed 4-1 with Ron Futcher. Who's he? I hear you all say played getting
for
a
Luton.
Hat-trick.
Played for Luton.
I know. Well, he could have got 5 or 6. I mean, we got really seriously dubbed. The only thing that... in fact, actually, I think I can't... I'm sure they might have done, but if I was writing the headlines, it would have been Futcher Butchers Chelsea, because that's pretty much what it was. But my favourite moment from that match is Mike Shannon, who, of course, a bit of a hero down where I come from, had transferred from Southampton. And I could seriously hear the two fantastic chants, Yeah, Shannon is a moron. Shannon is a moron. Do you remember that?
I do. And it just was perfect timing. And I do love that about football fans, sometimes spontaneity. Gilda John was in the chart at that moment. And that chant got... We should bring it back. We should find, you know... So Shannon got it throughout the game, but also when we played away later in the season, when McKenzie goes back to Everton, and the Everton fans were so cross at selling Duncan McKenzie, when McKenzie scores early doors, the whole stadium gets up to cheer McKenzie, even the Everton fans, and they were singing Gordon is a moron about Gordon Lee.
Wow.
And then when we play Manchester United, by sheer luck, Man United had Gordon McQueen playing and Joe Jordan playing. So we got both in the shed. We got Jordan is a moron and Gordon is perfect. So yeah, if a player called Gordon plays at Stamford Bridge next season, we have to bring that chant back. But that was the only memorable part about the game. I think they described our goal when Gary Stanley scored late on as a modicum of respectability.
I know. I remember Brian Moore saying that. I'm thinking, what have you been smoking, Brian? Yeah. The other thing that caught my ear, as opposed to my eye from this, is one of my favourite chants of all time. Not that I don't think it was ever sung since I've been going, but mates of mine used to giggle about it. And I used to sing it on the fan cast, which was... it was just before our goal, I think. Whoever fouled us... I don't know, I can't remember. But anyway, the crowd come out with, hit him on the head, hit him on the head, hit him on the head with a baseball bat. Oh, yeah, oh, yeah. Which is absolutely one of my favourite chants. I mean, all I have to say about that match and really, you know, that period up until the Bolton game is that, you know, Langley couldn't finish his dinner and our defence was woeful. And the only other thing I noticed was that the porn ads had gone from Stamford Bridge. No more ads for dirty movies like Emmanuel. They're now Beans Means Heinz, which I thought was that's the kind of stuff that I'm interested in. No, I'm joking. But I just thought it was an interesting observation. But I mean, we were...
Gola, Chidge.
A Gola, yes, absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
I had a pair of Gola boots. I think I may have been swayed by the advertising.
Yeah, yeah, there you go. I mean... It's funny watching these games back, and I wrote these little notes down, you know. And I was talking to Mark before we went on air, Jonathan, and my, you know, if you watch all the matches that we've been able to watch today, you would say, as I said, Langley couldn't finish his dinner.
Langley out of his depth all season.
But Mark says he got the Player of the Year award.
Nonetheless, you despaired as to why had they got rid of Finiston. I suppose Shalito decided he felt that Langley would fit with McKenzie, but I did. And then they got rid of Garner as well, who was always a very decent target.
Yeah, he went off on the 2nd of November to Cambridge United, yeah. I mean, the other thing is, I would say, is the observation that I had was just how woeful the defence was.
Oh.
But I think there's some mitigation there because, I mean, Mark will remind me when, but Mickey Droy missed about 4 months because he had a kidney operation or something, didn't he? Which won't have helped.
You're absolutely right. But the other thing that probably won't have helped either, during the course of that season, we had 13 different centre-back partnerships. So there was no stability in our defence. You know, we kept chopping and changing, sometimes through injury, sometimes through suspension, sometimes through the manager. So many different pairings. And we had, I think, at least four goalkeepers during the course of the season as well. So there was a lot of chopping and changing, you know, in our defence. So that didn't help either. The only thing I want to say about Tommy Langley is I thought he had a good season. He got 16 goals. But I do agree he did sort of miss a lot of chances. That he almost had to have three to get one.
Bit like Batshuayi.
A bit like Batshuayi, yeah.
Don't tell Tommy we said that. He might be listening. If you're listening, Tommy, I always loved you anyway. And I was not at QPR when the Chelsea fans sang, "Shoot Tommy Langley, we're going to shoot Tommy Langley."
He said that.
Am I right, Mark?
He said it was the biggest mistake of his life, yeah, joining QPR. He wished he'd never done it.
He's a proper Chelsea boy, bless him. But
he told a decent story about that, didn't he? About how he was just persuaded by being told you're getting £100 a week more. And he just found himself saying yes.
Wasn't it Jonathan? Who was the chairman of QPR at that time? Was it Jim Gregory?
Yeah, might have been. Yeah,
I think he said that. Yeah, he. And then Tommy Docherty was manager, I think, I remember. And I think he was locked in the room with Jim Gregory. I don't think they'd let him out until he agreed to sign.
Right, we're going to spin forward to, I think, a game that most people remember most fondly in this season. I mean, we only won five matches all bloody season, so it wouldn't be hard. But just judging by what people were saying on Twitter this afternoon, Mark, a lot of people remember this fondly. It's when we played Bolton Wanderers on the 14th of October, only to find ourselves 3-0 down. If I can actually read, Gowling scores in 17 minutes. Frank Worthington, bless him, gets a penalty on 36, and then Gowling scores another on 40. So we're 3-0 down in the first half, playing like absolute shit. But it all changes, doesn't it, in the second half, Mark? In fact, actually, in the last 20 minutes.
It does all in the last 20 minutes. And it's great on Twitter today just watching that and just people's comments in there and people's wonderful memories of that game. I've said many times, this is in my top 10, probably top 5 Chelsea games of all time. And I think it's one of those games you had to be there to experience it. You know, I think I've said, you know, when that fourth goal goes in, when Chelsea come back from there, there's not like steam rising from the shed end, you know, and, you know, people invaded the pitch. It was just euphoria. But, you know, we went in at halftime 3-0 down. And at that point, I had my season ticket. I used to stand in the right-hand side of the shed. And, you know, you had the old moaners around you. You know, and this one guy said, "Oh,
did you enough. Used to sit next to Jonathan then?"
had this, you know, person moaned every week, but clearly he had something to moan about that day. And he waves his season ticket in the air as he's exiting the ground and says, "Oh, that's it, I've had enough. Does anybody want my season ticket?" And there was no takers because it's a.
It was dismal. That first half was so completely dismal. I remember, you know, you come back wearily after you've attempted to have a wee in the East Stand, and you've failed miserably because there are too many queues, and you realise that if you don't return to your seat, you'll miss at least 15 minutes of the second half. And then I was thinking, well, will it matter? They'll probably score another couple of goals, so I might as well carry on and have me wee. And so I think I can't remember the first goal where a Chelsea goal went in. I think I missed it because I was having a wee, or I went off.
What happened, John?
I can't remember that.
Yeah. Clive Walker came on after sort of 71 minutes, but
after 70 booed. Minutes, wasn't it? Yeah.
Booed because the player Shellotto took off was Gary Stanley. And Gary Stanley was probably one of the few players that day that was playing well. And everyone's going, "What are you taking him off for? You could take all the rest of them off." So Walker comes on to a crescendo of boos. But within 1 minute, you know, we've got a goal back through Tommy Langley. And then, you know, 12 minutes later, you know, we make it sort of 3-2 with Kenny Swain. Walker himself gets the third. And I can't remember, but it was like a two-touch goal that it starts in defence. It might have been Ron Harris, but I could be wrong. It could have been, you know, one of the defenders. You know, I think David Hay was playing that day. And they do
last game for us, mate.
Yeah, they do one pass to Wilkins in the centre of the park. He does one pass to Walker, and Walker just takes on the fullback, which was can't remember the fullback was for Bolton, and he makes it 3-3. And then there's just only one winner in this game, and there was a brilliant tweet put up by Martin Booth today, because I think Rick Glanville asked the question, has anyone ever asked Sam Allardyce about that fourth goal for Chelsea? And Martin Booth comes up and says he won't name it, he knows someone that has. Yeah, and clearly Big Sam was not impressed when he was asked about that, because it's a glorious moment when Walker puts that ball in and Allardyce clumsily puts the ball into his net, and from 3-0 down to 4-3 in just 20 minutes. You know, there was only a 19,000 crowd that day, but I'd have to say there was a lot less than 19,000 there, because a lot of people had left at half time, but people just went mad at the end. It's an incredible experience.
Excellent stuff.
I saw the fourth goal through, you know, there was a gap at the edge of the stand before there was a little bit of greenery where the floodlight pylon was. Do you remember that? Just at the end of the east stand, there was a little gap. And I don't know why I'd left. I'd left at 3-3 with a minute to go. I've no idea why. And I saw the goal through the gap, and was sort of just bemused. I was so disappointed in them as a side at the time that it didn't give me any hope, I'm afraid, that game. That was the problem with it. I just remember thinking, it's all right, they may have come back, and Walker's played out of his skin, because a lot of the time he doesn't. A lot of the time he kicks the ball too far ahead and runs after it and doesn't get to it, but kicks the ball aimlessly. But he came on and was brilliant. But I was so, because we'd had such a run of uselessness, I suppose there's always a feeling that there's going to be, you know, it'll be, there's hope, but it's a false dawn. So I'm afraid,
the hope that kills you, mate.
It was dashed, that's right, it was dashed.
And it was a false dawn again, because, you know, basically, I think after the Bournemouth game, we were in 21st position, and we'd been in the bottom three since we lost to City, which was back in September, I think. So 16th of September, we were in the bottom three since then. We only won twice in the first 3 months. And then we play Man United at home on the 25th of November. A very strong United side, it has to be said. This is, of course, under our old manager, Dave Sexton. But if you look at this United side, Gary Bailey, Brian Greenough, Stuart Houston, Sammy McElroy, Gordon McQueen, also known as Gordon is a Moron, Martin Buchan, Steve Coppell, Jimmy Greenough, Joe Jordan, Liam McCorry, and Mark, a certain Mickey Thomas making his debut.
He did make his debut that day.
They went on to win the FA Cup, didn't they, that year? No, they didn't. They lost to Arsenal, didn't they?
They lost in the final to that last-minute Southend goal.
Yeah, the five-minute final.
I think they bought him that week, because in the programme, the number 11 was a guy called Tommy Sloan, who was down to play. So I don't remember Tommy Sloan. So Mickey Thomas came in to replace him. And I think he made the goal. I think Greenough scored it. Just a couple of things just going to mention following on from that Bolton game and that, you know, sort of feeling afterwards. There was a feeling for optimism as well, briefly, because Brian Mears had flown out to Yugoslavia to talk to Milan Milinic, who was the then Yugoslavian coach, but also managed Real Madrid. And there was a lot of talk. And if you watch the video for that Bolton game, at the start of the video, he's sitting in the East Stand. And there was talk of him becoming sort of like a director of football, with Shalito remaining coach. But
I really remember that. That was very obvious. He was very much in the press at the time as a consequence. Yeah.
And he actually said after the Bolton game, you know, he didn't need to join Chelsea because they didn't need him on the back of that one game. And we were going, no, we need him. We need him. Yeah. And for some reason, he kept Mears talks about it in his book. You know, he kept having that dialogue, but never pushed it over the line. And then Shalito gradually got nervous, having originally agreed to the idea, and Mears suggested that Shalito had been put off by some of the other England managers. They said, this is a thin end of the wedge, you know, a foreign manager coming in to manage an English club where he looks sort of 40 years on where we are today. And then the other thing to flag, we played Norwich City, and it's a Duncan McKenzie story, and Norwich were managed by John Bond. And, you know, McKenzie was doing all his flicks and tricks, you know, and I think he wound up John Bond over at the touchline. So John Bond, sort of, you know, his back heels and stuff like that, you know, accosts McKenzie when a throw comes in and says something. So, why do you keep doing that? Are you, you know, and McKenzie goes, because I can.
Love it.
Because I can. You know, good enough to do that jump. Yeah. But yeah, the Man United game, really, really disappointing. And I think that was when you really began to think, you know what, this isn't working. In that game, I think if you listen to it, you can hear the crowd chanting for Eddie McCready, you know, on the videotape. And though, you know, the signs from then on that, yeah, home games, people chanting for Eddie McCready. And there's a slight, and people who haven't watched it, go onto YouTube and watch it. If you watch that video clip of that Man United game, just before the end of the game, and I think John Motson talks about Brian Mears leaving his seat before the end of the game, you look third on the row, and there's a gentleman there with white hair and a beard. This is 1970.
Not Father Christmas.
And it's not Father Christmas or the Smurfs either. It's a Kenneth William Bates, who was there as Brian Mears' guest that day.
Weird, weird. I mean, it was a nadir in a sense, wasn't it? I mean, what I would say, I mean, Brian Moore mentions it on commentary that, you know, that we looked like a team completely lacking in confidence by then. I have to say, what tickled me watching the game was how brilliant the Chelsea support was, Jonathan. It was just really vociferous and behind the team. I mean, I get what Mark's saying about the Eddie McCready, but they it was a proper old, and was really good, the atmosphere, I thought.
Unless they left at half time, of course. But those that remained were very keen to show their support. I mean, that's a constant, Chidge. There's always a core who are. I think lots of them were the same people who went away. I think nowadays there's much more of a difference. You get people who only go away. Or you get stalwarts going away, but in this instance, it was an adventure supporting the team. But just to bring it back to this Milanovic, whatever his name was, I remember at the time being so hoping that they would get him because they so needed something else to happen to them as a team. I was just bemused by the lack of quality players in comparison with some of these other teams who came down, like Man United, as you said, had some really top players. And I was also in despair at the fact that they'd allowed it to go like this when the McKenzie signing seemed to sum it up, which was they'd bought a talented character, which is the kind of person that they'd had before and made it work. But they'd around him, they hadn't got the same kind of players. So they were always going into games just looking outclassed. I keep going about it. You know, the Man City game that you mentioned where they were completely taken to the cleaners had Barnes, another terrific player. They had Hartford, another great player. As you said, had Channon. Every team had four or five really class players. And Chelsea didn't have any. They had Wilkins, who was hot and cold because he was having to take the brunt, full brunt of it. But other than that, it just didn't stand out as a team, unfortunately.
Well, we've still got about half of the season to go. We're going to get into that in the next part three. But before we do that, a little gentle reminder that we do have what they call a Patreon account, which is a kind of a website where you can support what we do on the Chelsea Fancast and help cover the costs of running all the shows that we do and hopefully allow us to continue doing them. So if you want to donate, doesn't matter how much, as little or as much as you like, but you pay like a monthly donation via Patreon, which is patreon.com/ChelseaFancast. Also, it's a good way to get in touch with us. You know, I have the app, so if you send a message on there, I see it and I try and respond as quickly as I can. So thank you to all of our wonderful Patreons. It really is very, very much appreciated that you do continue to donate a little bit every month, in spite of the fact that I don't do what all the other people who have Patreon accounts do and actually do something for it. I think we do the show. I think that's kind of what I'm saying, but there you go. Right, part three coming up with the second half of the 78-79 season. See you in a minute.
Chidge.
JK, in all the years you've been following Chelsea, you hardly ever miss a match, home or away. But how would you feel if you couldn't be there and it's not on TV?
Oh, Chidge, I'd be bereft. Inconsolable. The thought of missing my beloved Blue Boys live. It's all too much.
I know, JK, I know. It's all a bit too much, isn't it?
Yes.
Well, panic not. NordVPN have come to the rescue.
They have?
Yep. NordVPN allows us to watch any match, even if it's not on live TV here.
They do?
Yeah, they do. With just one click, they switch your virtual location to a country which is showing the match, and they act as your cyber bodyguard whilst online, protecting your personal data and sensitive info like card details and passwords.
Oh, wow, great. But yeah, I bet that'll cost me a fortune.
Actually, JK, it's only the price of a cup of coffee per month, and you can use your account across 6 devices. It's a bargain, JK. And best of all, no more tears for you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, NordVPN. I'm so happy. I could cry. Where do I sign up, Ginge?
Well, to get the best discount off your NordVPN plan, go to nordvpn.com/Chelsea Fancast. There's no risk with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee, and you'll help support the Chelsea Fancast. The link is in the podcast episode description box. Away days are great, but there's nothing quite like playing at home. The same goes for McDonald's. Maximise your home ground advantage with McDelivery. You in? Order now on the McDonald's app. At participating restaurants, 18 plus, serving times, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
Real fans, real opinions.
I'm Jason Cundy, and you're listening to Chidge and the Boys on the Chelsea Football Fancast. Total nutters and proper Chelsea.
Footballfancast.com.
Welcome back. This is Jamford Chidge and the Chelsea Fancast with Mr. Jonathan Kidd.
Curry.
The Right Honourable Jonathan Kidd, in fact.
Oh, Chidgerama.
And because you are a member of my Privy Council, think about it.
Is that in your loo?
Well, you're always going to the loo at half time.
Yeah, that's quite. I have to tell you the truth. Occasionally I don't. Occasionally I get a cup of tea.
You do. I know. And I've got the Right Honourable Mark Meehan, who is a member of the Star Chamber, not the Star Chamber pot, I hasten to add, although he did go off for a wee.
I did indeed, but I didn't have a cup of tea, so I won't need to go to a wee again for the rest of the show.
Good man. All right, let's crack on because there's still so much to talk about. We kind of left you hanging in suspenders, really, with Chelsea losing at home to Man United 1-0 on the 25th of November 1978. Chelsea then had another game at home against Aston Villa and they lost that 1-0 on the 9th of December. And then the shit hit the fan because basically Ken Shillito gets the boot on the 13th of December. And then for about 8 hours, Frank the Tank Upton is made manager. I've got a very funny story about this. And then Danny Blanchflower is made manager on the 14th of December. Now, when I did the Chelsea specials, and I had a great interview with Gary Chivers, who is hilarious, by the way. It's well worth listening to this. He told me the story about this, that the players were all hanging around. Ken had been fired. And then Frank turns up, says, "I'm the new gaffer. Call me gaffer." And they all knew that he hadn't been made manager. And then lo and behold, 6 hours later, he was not manager and it was Danny Blanchflower. So poor old Frank had been sold a bit of a lemon there, I think. But I mean, clearly the right decision, Mark. Yeah.
Yeah, clearly the right decision. Again, as I said, when we talked about Man United, the Villa game before, people were calling for Eddie McCready to come back. I think Shillito himself had actually tried to resign before that, and Brian Mears persuaded him to stay on. But I think they amicably came to the conclusion. And on the Frank Upton thing, he was manager for less than a day. I've got a slight variation on that same story. It involves Peter Osgood, that when Frank Upton got the job and he came into the dressing room, he said to all the players, "Right now, lads, you're going to have to call me boss." And Osgood joined that day. Peter Osgood had just come back that day. And he sort of says, cheekily, "Whatever you say, Frank." Round Frank up, no end. And then soon after, within 24 hours, Danny Blanchflower's got the job. So Upton sticks his head round the door again and he says to him, "It's okay, lads, you can call me Frank again."
Brilliant. Yeah, it's a good variance. It's much the same kind of story from Gary. before we get onto Ozzie returning, which you've teased beautifully there, Mark, Danny Blanchflower, I mean, rather than going with the hindsight of what we now know, but what did you both think of Danny Blanchflower being appointed? Jonathan?
He'd be one of the great players in the 50s and 60s. And he'd captain Spurs to the double, and they were the push and run side of the period. They were a passing team, and they were pretty innovative because of this way of playing, which didn't involve the long ball as much as most teams played. And so there was the possibility that he might bring back that kind of football. I think he even mentioned that in a speech which he was giving to the press. But I personally don't understand what was going on in the club at the time, in that they get rid of McCready, they appoint somebody who can't do it, who is clearly inept, and they appoint somebody equally just not right for a first division club. I suppose if they were bottom.
Did you know that at the time, though?
You hoped that there would. You wondered why. You wondered why he'd.
It was a bit of a weird appointment,
right? It was a
right?
weird appointment. But at the same time, he was out of your folklore. He'd captained Northern Ireland. He was on Match of the Day as a pundit. He expressed himself very well. He was charming. He was a gentleman. And you thought,
how did he speak, Jonathan?
A bit like that. There was a kind of sort of, you know, it was sort of slightly posh Belfast voice he had. Seriously, he did. It was sort of, you know. Well, you know, I remember watching Match of the Day the other day. There was a Match of the Day that I think it was Cheltenham, whatever it was. I came and they asked him, and he was a bit rubbish. Let's be frank; he was a bit on his toes. Well, that wasn't a very good game, was it? It was a bit how can I put it? A bit un. You could think, no, say something else, Danny. Say something else. But at the same time, this was new. This was Wolstenholme handing over to him live at the game. Not live; it was recorded after the game, so it was all new. So you forgave them everything, and he was Danny Blanchflower, been a terrific player, really terrific player, and he'd won the double, as I said, with Spurs. So there was a hope. Yes, what will, you know, as always, what will this man bring to the club? What are we going to get here? But when you think about it, with all these other thrusting managers, it was clearly somebody who they were paying a tenner a week to. And the more you think about it, the more it was all, it was a fire sale. Let's get in somebody just to get us through to the end of the season and then we'll go down. It was, that was the way it appeared to be to me. There was no hope. And meanwhile, the club are still plummeting towards bankruptcy, aren't they?
Yeah, they're still skint. They're still
completely skint. So that's why they got him in. You think it was something altruistic and he was going to present his great philosophy of football and it would work. But no, he was decent, a very decent journalist, a very decent man, but clearly not up for the job.
Mark, would you agree with all of that? Have you got anything to add to that?
Yeah, it's a strange appointment, and there wasn't even any time for any press speculation because, you know, Ken Shillitoe, I think, went on the 13th, and then Danny Blanchflower was there on the 14th. So there really wasn't any time to think about it. And it was quite strange because the night before Shillitoe got the push or stood down, I was at Charlie Cook's testimonial, and it was only about 6,000, and there was no real campaign to get rid of Shillitoe, even though I said they might chant for Eddie McCready. There was no Shillitoe out, and there was no sense perhaps this was coming. And even sort of Brian Mears in his book, you know, he even said himself, I never thought of Danny as a club manager, particularly for Chelsea. And then when he introduced to the other directors, they never thought he was a manager either.
So why do they hire him? You know, why did they hire him then?
Why did they hire him? So was it we were already resigned to relegation and he was available? You know, because Brian Mears in his book talks about John Bonds, Terry Venables. Venables was a young up-and-coming coach. I think he was at Crystal Palace at that time.
Ex-Chelsea, of course.
Yeah, and ex-Chelsea. And, you know, he even says about John Bond, who had a good track record at Norwich City. Yeah. You know, yeah, I first thought of John Bond, you know, who later went on to Manchester City. But somehow I could never see John Bond as a manager of Chelsea. So, yeah, very strange appointment. And, you know, in hindsight, yeah, probably a bad appointment. Definitely a bad appointment.
Indeed. Now, talking of bad appointments or strange ones, did any of you see this happening, which is actually the same day that Danny Blanchflower was appointed the Chelsea manager on the 14th of December, The Return of the King. Peter Osgood comes back from Philadelphia Fury for $25,000, JK.
Well, once again, our hopes were high, Chidge.
You've been calling for him for the last 4 years.
Yes, I know. But by then, he was a shadow of the player he'd been, unfortunately. So, and it was pretty obvious after his first appearance, when he didn't do much, didn't look very mobile, and fouled a lot of people. So it was a disappointment. But yeah, once again, we thought, well, you know, look what's going to happen now. There's always this thing there's this hope. He's always thinking, oh, I wonder what's going to happen now. Perhaps he'll galvanise the side. Perhaps they'll make an effort. But they were out of their depth in that division and they were headless and they weren't being given the right advice. So...
Did you welcome Ozzy back with open arms, Mark?
I did, because I'd only seen him a few times in the 70s as a player. So I think when we spoke, that even the first time I went to Chelsea, Ozzy wasn't even playing. But there'd been a lot of press speculation prior to him joining us that he was coming back from America. So his name was even being sung on the terrace before he came back. So there was that excitement that Peter Osgood came home. He was back, the king of Stamford Bridge. But other than a couple of, you know, obviously the first game he plays in Middlesbrough when he scores that goal, a couple of fits and starts, you know, I don't think he was fully fit. And there was
Never looked fit, Mark, ever.
Yeah, didn't look fit at all. You know, he even played midfield at times. I think he played sweep on one occasion or two occasions. It just never happened.
He played in central defence, didn't he?
It never happens. You know, just really, really sad. And, you know, then he fell out with Jeff Hurst and then he left the following season.
All very, very odd. Also very odd, which I must have been like a dagger to the heart for you, JK, was Kenny Swain being sold to Villa for $100,000 the same day.
Well, that was another sale to appease the bank manager, wasn't it? Clearly,
must have been, because he went on to win the European Cup with Villa as a fullback 2 years later.
He was one of the best players. He was a terrific, terrific player. And meanwhile, Butch is still hanging on. That's the thing.
We'll get to Butch later, but indeed, there are other. The interesting thing is, I'll tease it now, and I'll try and do this chronologically. But there are quite a lot of other comings and goings towards the end of the season that raise quite a few eyebrows, I think. But before we get to that, we should talk about the noteworthy first game in charge for said Danny Blanchflower. When Chelsea go to what was in those days Ayresome Park to play Middlesbrough. There can't be too many Chelsea managers, Mark, whose first game ends in a 7-2 defeat.
I don't recall any Chelsea managers whose first game ends in a 7-2 defeat, and especially after they take the lead as well.
With Osgood scoring on his return back to the club.
Yeah, Osgood had... Yeah. Awful result. And if you're going to get beat 7-2, you know, if we'd lost, say, to the Liverpool side of that season, you might have understood it because, you know, they were a very good side, you know, that season, or the Nottingham Forest side. But losing 7-2 to Middlesbrough, bloody hell.
Quite astonishing, isn't it? I mean, they were actually only five places above us at the time.
Yeah.
So, as you say, it wasn't like we were playing Liverpool, was it? We follow that up with a 5-1 defeat away to Ipswich a few matches later. Now, that's no shame, actually, because Ipswich were a pretty decent side at the time. I think they'd won the FA Cup that year, hadn't they? 78?
They 78 with Roger Osborne, yeah.
Yeah, they were the cup holders.
It was the penultimate day of the year. I actually wrote about this game in CFC UK this year, a few issues back. You know, I went to this game. It was freezing up there. It was snowing. And we got an absolute tonking that day. You know, so we lost 5-1, and it could easily have been more. I think we were 4-0 down just after the second half had started. We really did not play well that day.
Well, talking of snow, mate... you know, having watched these games back, probably the only other relative high point of the season. Well, there's this and there's another match, which I will go into in a minute. But we go up to Man City on the 20th of January. We find ourselves 1-0 down after 8 minutes. Remember, they'd tonked us 4-1 earlier in the season. But the thing that just I find remarkable about this was just the snow, actually. I mean, it was like the last time I've seen a match like that was when we played Tromso away. I mean, and of course that funny orange ball that they played with.
They were very loath to call games off in those days.
They were, weren't they?
They used to say it's the same for both sides.
Yeah, of course, which is true.
Was it? Well, no, but it wasn't. It wasn't because one side frequently had ball players, expensive, skillful players who were rendered into slithering idiots. Can I just take a sec before we get on?
Well, before you do, just to qualify that point, I agree with you, actually, because you can't say that. And then when you get a cup match where you have to go and play Hereford away in a cow field, right, and then say, oh, it's a great level of the pitch. Yeah. Which is what they always used to say, wasn't it?
They always used to say, yeah. But it's like Wolves when they beat Honved, who were supposed to be the world champions in the 50s. They watered the pitch because they knew that the Hungarians had a slick passing game. And so all that Wolves did was boot the ball up the wings and centre it and then smash the ball into the net by barging the goalkeeper in. And they won that way. So they cheated Wolves in order to maintain the superiority of the English game, because that's what the English game was based on at the time. So it's a leveller to the extent that it means that one side, the better footballing side, can't play and is brought down by the elements. But just to digress, I was at the Man United Chelsea game at Old Trafford with Hugh Hastings, the photographer and the publisher and the editor of the programme. And I lay with him behind the goal as a photographer. I had a press pass. And Johnson played for Chelsea and was consistently bullied by Greenhoff, who was playing right back. But what was so remarkable was that Bailey, the Man United goalkeeper, was abused by Greenhoff nonstop. This is Brian Greenhoff, who was Jimmy Greenhoff's brother, fullback, for being useless. And he kept saying, you're fucking useless, fucking useless, fucking kick it. And Bailey, of course, was a South African. And I'd no idea that kind of thing happened within your own team. And yet they won 3-0. He was just constantly at him. And as being lying with the photographers, you just heard this banter nonstop. But I remember being absolutely bemused by Osgood's performance, who was, once again, to go back to it, fat, out of condition, unfit, and just niggly. And I thought, this is absolutely a waste of time.
And yet he scores.
This is 3-0. This is Man United Chelsea away.
Oh, the cup match.
Yeah.
I mean, going back to the City match, he scores. I mean, we win 3-2, with a breakaway Clive Walker goal on 79 minutes. Ozzy scores, yes. So does Duncan McKenzie, scores with a free kick to equalise, which was in fact his last appearance, Mock. So why it was his last appearance? Because, I mean, he does get sold about 2 months later to Blackburn for 80 grand. But why was it his last appearance, Mark?
Out of favour of Blanchfield didn't rate him. So if you look then, he doesn't actually play him much after he becomes manager.
Well, that is his final appearance.
He doesn't figure at all. I think Duncan was also homesick. As I mentioned earlier, I've got his book. But there is tragedy, sadly, if people don't know this, that he'd just become a father and his son, Ross, around about that time, dies from a cop death.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so not many people sort of know that. And I was reading his book, and I knew that because Kenny Swain had told me that. But then when you read it and it really hits you. So he actually moved to Blackburn, and I think he took a drop of a couple of divisions, and a drop in salary as well, just to move back home. Because I think his wife was still up in the northwest of England from when he'd been at Everton. And then it was 11 years before they had another child, and they got a daughter, so they had to wait that long. So very sad. I think that part of the reason why he moved back as well. But also, he wasn't being played by Blanchard, which was a shame. So yeah, the City was his swan song game. I think the other thing I'd add about that sort of weather, it was a different kind of winter of discontent. Actually, there was a number of games, strange enough, we had postponed around then. The only game we had up until the City game from Christmas was the Man United Cup game Jonathan was just talking about. Our games against Arsenal, Coventry, all postponed. So we had a lean period of hardly playing any football. So that Manchester City game is all the more surprising, as we hadn't had a league game for 3 weeks. And then there's another great clip talk about when games amazingly went on. As you find it, Arsenal played Sheffield Wednesday in the Cup when we played Man United. And Pat Jennings up at Hillsborough gets absolutely pelted with snowballs by the Sheffield Wednesday fan. It's absolutely brilliant to watch. But
yeah, I remember that. Yeah. I remember that.
And then we have our run of two wins when we beat Birmingham the following week.
Well, there we go. The high point of the season. I mean, this is around the time, just after this, it all gets a bit mental. And I need some explanation from you boys. On the one hand, we sell Steve Wicks to Derby County for $275,000. We sell Ray Lewington to Vancouver Whitecaps for $40,000. Oh. We buy Eamon Bannon from Hearts for $200,000. And we buy Peter Barota for $70,000 from Partizan Belgrade. What's going on, Mark? It's crazy.
Some very strange transfer dealings.
And that's what struck me.
Whether or not the board was saying to Blanchflower, if you want to bring any players in and sign any players, you had to sell players. But some of the players we sold, you know, were probably some of the strongest players in the side that season. You know, Wicks in defence, really strange decision. And again, Steve, another player, didn't want to leave, but yet we sold him. Kenny Swain, another player, didn't want to leave. Ray Lewington, didn't want to leave. So very strange.
A bizarre club to go to, Vancouver Whitecaps. You'd have thought, you know, obviously they just came in for him. I mean, you'd have thought Lewington was a decent player and had really done well under McCready, of course. Who was playing him? He called him his tank, didn't he? So you. What I find dreadful is the fact that the way they played under McCready, which was so obviously very novel, and it was very radical way of playing, was just ignored by managers who were just incapable of understanding that they before the team had played in a very specific way that had made them into a really good force, and they just weren't playing that way anymore.
Well, it kind of all gets a bit surreal for me, I think. And again, when we summarise and reflect on this, I shall grill you both on this. But in a sense, there's only one, you know, good positive match of note, I think, for the rest of the season, and it happens to be Petr Barota's debut. And I watched this. I think it was match of the day. They had it on Chelsea against Liverpool on the 3rd of March, 1979.
The big match, Chidge.
It was the big match. My apologies. It's funny, isn't it? I only watched it about 3 hours ago. Anyway, whatever. Bizarre, absolutely bizarre. We're bottom of the league, pretty much, or 21st. Liverpool are top, hunting down another title. Probably European champions as well, no doubt. And yet we seem to have an Indian sign on this side because we play out of our skins. I mean, frankly, you know, we hit the post. It's twice. It's cleared off the line. We were so much the better side, and basically Liverpool were very lucky to get away with a 0-0 win. And it just kind of belies the absolute shit that Chelsea managed to serve up for most of that season, Jonathan.
Well, you just wonder whether they just get inspired by certain games, and they've a good record against Liverpool, so. But it is very peculiar. You'd have thought they'd take to put, the cleaners, don't you, really?
To put this into context, given who we've just sold, right? Oh. We've got John Sitton and Mickey Nutton playing.
Who were never great players. I have to say, I think Bannon was a decent signing because he was very industrious. And once again, you do that thing of thinking, oh, who's this player? He must be good. They've paid 200,000 for him. And he had a very good press. And he got about all over the pitch, you know. So he was a decent player. And I haven't got a great memory of the game, I'm afraid, Gidge. Did Walker play? I can't remember.
Clive Walker play. I'll give you the team: Peter Barota, Graham Wilkins, David Stride, Eamon Bannon, John Sitton, Mickey Nutton, Gary Stanley, Ray Wilkins, Ron Harris, Tommy Langley, and Clive Walker. Mark, one of the things that intrigued me about this is that Ron Harris is wearing the number 9 shirt. What was all that about?
This is the Ron Harris Irish coffee story. Ron wasn't down to play. Peter Osgood was down to play. And Ron was in the restaurant in the East Stand before the game. He'd had a fine lunch. He had a few glasses of wine. And he'd had a large number of Irish coffees for dessert. So this is about 1:30 on the day of the game when the call comes through that Osgood has failed a fitness test and won't be playing. So Harris of deputised for Osgood, but he actually plays centre of midfield. And actually, you know, there's a couple of
plays well
in the game where he nearly scores a couple of blinding goals. And the journalist Jeff Powell afterwards said it was Ron Harris's best game for Chelsea in 17 years. Yeah. And
wow.
Brilliant yellow card. I don't know if you remember when you're watching it, where he just literally just comes in behind David Johnson.
And yeah.
He studs in the back of David Johnson's leg right in front of the referee. That would get you a red card now. But, you know, just a typical Ron Harris challenge. He got there as soon as he could. Had to get that one in.
Yeah, it was. He did play really, really well. I mean, the whole side did. I mean, the other interesting things that drew my attention earlier on today. Clements clattering into Emlyn Hughes and leaving him pole on the ground. What a shame! But of course, it's our first sign of the Jekyll and the Hyde of Petr Borota, who comes out at every available opportunity, almost like you could put the clown music. You know, and then there's another great. I mean, he comes out almost to about 18, 20 yards, and misses the ball. But on the other hand, he pulls off this unbelievable acrobatic save, which had Brian Moore purring from Kenny Dalglish. So, and he was. I mean, I watched the highlights of it today, and he was very much the feature of it. And of course, he gets a little interview afterwards. But welcome to Chelsea, Petr Borota. Mark,
a very eccentric character. So you didn't know what would happen next. Some of the saves he would pull off would take your breath away, but then some of the goals, you know, would have you tearing your hair out. And I think it was a couple of occasions where he was up the other end of the pitch trying to score a goal, get it back. Short period of time while he was there, you know, a real cult figure at Stamford Bridge, but that save he made from Dalglish, absolutely brilliant, brilliant, brilliant save.
Indeed. Nevertheless, we didn't win. We still remain very rooted to the bottom of the table. And really, you know, that last kind of run of games. I mean, it was interesting, actually, because Ray Wilkins was interviewed after that game and was saying, you know, but Brian Moore was being realistic and saying, well, really, you've got to win every game to stay up. And he said, well, why not? Well, what happened, Ray, was we lost every single one of them, apart from drawing 1-1 with Derby County and winning 2-1 against Middlesbrough. But in amongst all of that is a horrible 3-1 loss to QPR at home, a 6-0 drubbing away at Forest. No shame there. They're a damn good side, obviously. And a 5-2 defeat away to Arsenal. Do either of you two remember any of those horrors?
I remember all three. I was at all three, Chidge. The QPR game was probably, I think there was probably about a dozen games to go at that time. That's probably the time where I think I'd resign myself, you know, to relegation, you know, because I think we had a game in hand over QPR coming up. I think it might be the Derby game. But so we lost to QPR, so that was a 4-pointer. And then we played Derby and we were 1-0 up Derby. It might have been before, and I think Roy McFarlane scored in the 89 minutes, and I just thought, you know what? We're going down. And then we went to Forest, and obviously Forest were a really good side then. And another night where it was windy, it rained, it snowed, and the Chelsea support that night at the City Ground was tremendous. About 3,000 Chelsea fans doing that Chelsea chant for about the last half hour of the game. And that was quite important because we were already 6-0 down. We were down to 10 men. Actually, about 20 minutes ago, because John Sitton went off injured. So we played the last 20 minutes, 6-0 down at Nottingham Forest with 10 men. And for that last 20 minutes, Chelsea fans sang constantly. At the end of the game, the Forest fans, you know, gave the Chelsea fans a round of applause. And then in the next match programme, Brian Mears, you know, wrote a special piece about the travelling fans that night. Just tremendous Chelsea support. But then the Arsenal game, you know, what I've said about that Arsenal game, I wrote about it in Chelsea Here, Chelsea There. I think I said relegation didn't happen at Arsenal. It happened over the course of that whole previous 9 months. You know. But being at Highbury that day, grim. We were 3-0 down. Clive Walker made it 3-1. No, 2-1 down. 2-0 down. Clive Walker made it 2-1. And then Arsenal get three goals, I think, in about the last 10 minutes.
Well, 80 minutes, 82 minutes, 85 minutes.
And then Tommy Langley gets his cracking goal from about 20 yards out, but too little, too late. And just got this memory Yeah, I was actually in the North Bank that day, rather than the clock end, but there weren't many Chelsea fans in the North Bank there. There was about 200. And we're all in one section of the North Bank, and then just walking up, head to the exit, and all you can hear is Arsenal fans, you know, singing, going down, going down, going down. Just, you know, really awful feeling being relegated. You know, so would not wish that on any Chelsea fan in the modern day Chelsea era. Relegation is awful.
Yeah, and I mean, to put a lid on it, two wins from our first 22 league games, worst ever Division One performance, relegated bottom on 20 points from 42 games, won 5, drew 10, lost 27. I mean, we know, obviously, because we're not, you know, we're talking about this, you know, 4 years down the line or whatever, that arguably there were worst seasons to come. But I, you know, it's a good question to ask. I mean, how bad does this rank in Chelsea's seasons?
Worst
ever. JK. Worst ever for you, Mark?
Worst ever season in Chelsea's history.
No, why so?
Yeah.
Why so?
Well, the relegation is a start, but just how badly we played that season, some of the defeats we had. In all my years supporting Chelsea, I don't remember a season as bad as that one. And even the signs were there, you know, even at the halfway point of the season and the whole of 1978. You gave the stats about two wins and 22 league games. We should have seen it there in 78 because we didn't play well in the second half of Schelotto's first season. If you look at the 42 games played in 1978, we only got 26 points. So the relegation were already there long before relegation happened. Yeah.
Jonathan, for you?
I found the whole of this period difficult, the whole of the 70s. The yo-yo aspect of it, the disappointment was... I mean, I'd written them off here before the last, you know, when they just had the run of games. I'd written them off about April, really. I just thought they were... It was a dreadful team. And their heads went down too soon. But, you know, I'm remembering from, I suppose, with the knowledge of how good we've become, you grinned and bore it. You know, it didn't stop you from supporting your team. But it was horrendously disappointing. And for me, it was relegation was inevitable. So it wasn't round about Bristol City, I think. So possibly earlier. So I was resigned to it, so it wasn't as hard a blow. I think if they'd been battling to stay up and then lost it in the last game of the season or something, last two games, I'd have been bitterly disappointed. But there was a kind of resignation that this was a poor team. And so you accepted it. But yeah, I agree completely with Mark. It was possibly the worst. But you know, I found all the decisions made subsequently, you look back in just disbelief. And the board weren't given enough grief by the fans. There was a kind of just acceptance. I don't understand why. Were we all ignorant? Did we not know the way football clubs worked? I think that was an element of it. We just thought, oh, well, they can't afford it or whatever. They've made some bad decisions. I mean, I you can't quite understand why they just sold four or five of the better players and kept Ray Wilkins. They possibly could have then sold Ray, then got 500,000 for him, and then bought about four better players to shore the team up. I know it would have been premature and he was the best player, but he didn't have a great season himself.
Well, you know, that's a good point, JK, and you don't know this, so your powers of segue-ness are masterful. But of course, obviously, we do end up selling Ray Wilkins to Man United that summer. But after the Man United game, which in many respects, I suspect really was the key match really in the season. It's the one that really led to Schelotto going. But this is what Mike Langley, I don't know the paper, one of the Sundays, no doubt, headlines, Exit Ray. Now, this is on the 25th of November, remember? And this is what he writes. Flop Wilkins needs a rest. Ray Wilkins of England ought to spend Wednesday night resting on the bench when the Czechs visit Wembley. He's a talented lad whose form and confidence have gone in trying to carry a side that would be lucky to avoid the bird at Rochdale. Who wants to hear 95,000 England supporters laughing if Wilkins falls head over heels and trying to control a square pass with no challenger within miles? That happened here. Chelsea have 2 million in debts, United have 2 million in players, but their superiority was confirmed into effort, to belief, and to liberal applications of Jordan's elbows. Blah, 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 blah. Right. I hope someone pulls him aside and convinces him that no other First Division team is quite as hopeless as Chelsea. A wall of silence, manager Ken Shelletto's phrase, has now been erected around Stamford Bridge. Everyone from the chairman downwards is supposed to be gagged. Chelsea proclaim, "We'll let our football do our talking for us." Well, what their football said in this fourth consecutive defeat is rubbish. I just happened to catch that earlier on today, really just by mistake, you know, as one does. And I just thought, wow, that kind of encapsulates this season so beautifully. And I think also brings us on very pertinently and poignantly about Ray Wilkins, because we now know with hindsight that he struggled terribly with the pressure that was wrought upon him of being Chelsea's only player, the captain, and everything else. It affected his mental state. I think he got depression, all sorts of things. I saw that interview that the Big Match did after the Liverpool game today. And I remember, I know Ray. You know, I got to know him pretty well, 10, 15 years ago or so. And okay, I know he was a lot younger, but I watched it was heartbreaking watching that interview, because this was not the Ray Wilkins that we know. He looked absolutely skittish, nervous, very ill at ease. And I think it kind of, now knowing what we now know, you can just tell that this was a young man, no pun intended with Ray, but under huge pressure and really, really struggling with his game, with himself, with the huge weight that he carried on his shoulders. And it was really sad to watch, actually. And I kind of look upon it now in a very different light than I would have done at the time, I think, JK.
Well, I think he, as I said, he clearly wasn't the same player he'd been the season before, and the season before that. And the mediocrity around him, I think, the same with McKenzie. He couldn't come up to it. It was too much for him, the whole pressure, as you say, of being supposedly the fulcrum of the side, and the fact that he wasn't influencing games and he was being caught in possession, and he wasn't being protected, because I think under Eddie McCready he was playing much further forward and had Lewington behind him. And it was just a much better setup, whereas in this instance, I think he was just playing midfield. He wasn't being given the ability to roam. And as you say, yes, of course, he was in the summer. He was sold, wasn't he? But it was. With hindsight, you look back and are bemused at the way that the club was being run at the time. It was just absolutely ridiculous. But it was once again the albatross of the stand, which they took a long time to shrug off.
Mm. Mark, what are your thoughts on what I was saying?
Yeah, I can see it, Chidge. He carried that team for so long. And while you're doing that, I dug out the yearbook for the start of that season. And like Ken Shelletto talks about the season that just ended, the 77-8 one, and how Ray Wilkins had come back early from injury. You know, he'd played under the handicap of a groin injury, but he was concerned that Chelsea were going to go down. So he came back early and rushed himself back. He knew the risk he was taking, but he was putting Chelsea first. And Ray Wilkins got injured again the season we're talking about. He got injured in the Charlie Cook testimonial. And he came back for that Birmingham game, which was the last game that we won before relegation. And time and time again, he put the club first before himself, his health, his well-being. I think the pressure as well, I think it was telling in the last penultimate home game when we lost to Ipswich at home, but everyone was just singing about, "Don't go, Wilkins, don't go." And it's almost like a gesture he makes to the crowd saying, like, you know, "I don't want it, but I have to." Because is that, I think that pressure on Chelsea had to sell him, you know, to get some money in. Because even Blanchflower, who was quite astute at managing the press, in the Arsenal game when we get relegated, you know, what crops up again? Ray Wilkins is the story. And Harry Miller, who wrote for the Mirror, asked Danny Blanchflower. Yeah, and he says, "I've got a good club but a bad team. If I could get £1 million for two defenders, I wouldn't need to sell Ray Wilkins. I've brought in Peter Brutt and Amy Brandon, but that is not enough. So Blanche was there saying, once we got relegated, you know, if I'm going to build a team, I'm going to have to say Ray Wilkins. So the pressure was coming at Wilkins from all angles that he had to leave. You know, and the lovely part about that man, as I said it when I was on the show the other week, having spent time in his company, and when he came back for the first time and someone said to him, what are you doing here? You're a Red. And he goes, I've never been a Red. I've always been a Blue.
Yeah, that's a lovely way to finish it, I think, because it was a pretty depressing season, and it only really got worse in the summer when Ray went. A lot of, I was too young to really remember it, to be honest, but I know a lot of people wept a lot when Ray went. It was like the soul being ripped out of the club. That's it for this week and our 50 years of Chelsea. We will be back, of course, next week to do 1979-80. Which will be fun, I promise. Now, I mentioned it earlier on, but the Chelsea Special, of course, is a whole series of interviews I've done with players from this kind of era, with the wonderful Martin King. We've done Kerry Dixon, Bobby Tambling, Chopper Harris, Tommy Baldwin, Johnny Boyle, Johnny Bumstead, Gary Chivers, Colin Pates and Canners, and also Danny Harkins. And Chivers, Gary Chivers and Johnny B talk about this era coming up beautifully, as you can imagine. They're so, so, so well worth a listen, and you can download them at chelseaspecial.podbean.com for a small charge of each podcast, £2.99, which is cheaper than a pint of Guinness, and we've paid the players, so we need to kind of recoup the costs, really. And you can subscribe to Podbean, go to chelseaspecial.podbean.com, and then you see all of the episodes on the homepage, and just scroll down, have them all, or just pick out one, and when you do, you go buy single episode now. It takes you straight through to the payment window and pay your money, and then you can download it and listen to it as many times as you like. Follow us on Twitter at Chelsea_special. The website is chelseaspecial.com, and it's Chelsea Special on Facebook. It's the 90th minute. All your mates around. You've got your McNuggets share boxes ready to go. Your mates already got booked for double dipping, and you steal the last nugget, snatching all 3 points. Perfect. Order McDelivery now on the McDonald's app. You in? At participating restaurants, 18 plus, serving times, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
And there it is. That's as good as it gets on this stage. Nissan Townstar EV strikes again. It's an unstoppable van. Unstoppable!
Look, just fantastic. You can actually see the ProPilot technology in action. Effortless parallel parking.
It moves with all the confidence that comes with a 5-year warranty.
And with a bench full of all-star van experts, there's real strength in depth here.
That's all-star quality.
Search Nissan Townstar EV and visit your local all-star van centre to see for yourself.
Terms and conditions apply. 5 years or 100,000 miles, whichever comes first.
ProPilot is an advanced driver assist technology. Driver's responsibility to stay alert, drive safely, and control vehicle at all times.